Welcome to JW Community Podcast, where my mum is basically just blabbering on about nonsense.
Thank you, Phil.
Hello and welcome to another JW Community Podcast. I have got a really interesting guest today speaking to me, and I've invited him on because I want to pin down what happened in 1975 and what people said in 1976. Now, we'll talk about other things as well. This guest is he's made some really amazing things in his lifetime. Really, one particularly amazing thing in his lifetime. Hi, Dad.
Hi. You mean you?
I need to ask you, how's my stepbrother Norman doing?
Norman is fine. He sleeps all day and barks all night. But apart from that,
you've given the game away. I was going to say, when Joseph was sleeping with him, he was really sleeping with his step uncle.
Yeah, something like that. I never figured out the relationship.
But he's anyway. he is a dog. So that was that. Right. Thank God that joke.
Well, there are some people who back all night as well, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So, I've got a few questions that I wanted to ask you. I feel like I already know the answers, I'll be honest. But
yeah, you probably do.
But maybe not. So I wanted to ask you, going right back to the beginning, what it was like for you when you were first studying with the witnesses and how that went.
Well, as you know, we'd emigrated, we were living in Australia, so we were a long way from home. We were young, and Jehovah's Witnesses knock on your door, and we were willing to talk to anybody, I think, because when you're in a strange country, you don't know many people. And, you know, so we got into kind of a formal Bible study. And in the beginning, a lot of it sounds very interesting, very appealing, but not very credible. So you have a lot of questions, like most people do when they begin to study, and you don't always get the right answers or what seems like a rational answer. So I would say it took me a couple of years at least to become a witness, and it's really it's kind of a war of attrition, I suppose, you know, that like in the theatre, they have the expression suspension of disbelief. And I think that's what you do over a period of time, you know. All the things that are just about impossible to believe, you know, like the weird things of Noah being able to take millions of different species on the ark and to find them all, you know, would be ridiculous. But and so it comes down to, well, nobody can explain that, but Jehovah knows the answer, and we'll all know the answer in the new order, you know, because it'll become clear. His mind is greater than ours. So over a period of time, that kind of breaks down your resistance, and the appeal of the good things, like having a righteous government, living under a peaceful system where everybody gets along, and obviously everybody would love to have that. But
it's funny that you mention that, because most people go for pandas.
Okay. Yeah.
Everybody gets a free panda bear.
That's
a bit more of a noble reason.
Well, you know, I mean, there are many, many questions, and they come up all the time, but you have to kind of compartmentalize them and say, well, it doesn't really make sense, but, you know, let's deal with it later. So I would say that's how you become a witness from the beginning, because it's a completely different experience to somebody like yourself and a lot of other people who were born and raised in it. And so you have to come at it from a completely different angle.
Yeah, that is true. Oh, bugger, I forgot what I was going to say. I had a question. Never mind.
Five.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you.
Okay.
I was going to say, you were really brought in on the tidal wave of 1975, weren't you? There was a big push before then. You came in 69, right? And it was that little blue truth book thing.
Yeah, right. And I I think I got baptized in 71, so it was like 3 or 4 years in advance, and it's a distant memory now, but yeah, that was really a strong motivating force for most people back then, and it was definitely going to happen. I can't remember all the Watchtower articles and everything about it, but I know that was, you know, everything connected to 1970, the whole thing revolved around 1975. So when they told you, don't let your children go to college, because what's the point now?
What's the point, yeah.
There's only 2 years left to go. It's a bit of a waste of time, you know. So everything revolved around that. And so, yeah, and if you wanted to go back, and people do a bit more studious than I am and research all those articles that were published then, and you would see the emphasis that was put on what was going to happen just around the corner.
I've seen a thing that I don't know if it's real or not, but it looked real. And it was like a little tick box counting the months down, and it said on it, stay alive till 75.
I don't remember it specifically, but
no.
That was something in a Watchtower or a book.
Yeah, I think, I thought it was, I could be wrong. But I think, you know, a lot of what they said, I think was quite, it couldn't be interpreted. But when you look at stuff up, they don't commit as much to print as you think they have. So, for instance, I was trying to do a video once about women not being allowed to wear trousers, which to me was a massive, absolute hard and fast rule. You could not wear trousers. But I couldn't find it written anywhere. And it, like, hit me in the face. Where did I get this rule from? Why did I think it was such a strict rule when it's not written anywhere? And I think a lot of things are passed down in convention assemblies and talks.
Yeah, I think... I'm sure that's true. I mean, the same thing with men having beards, right? I mean, could you find anything where it says that the Bible says men can't wear beards? I don't think you could, but they all... atmosphere was that for some reason, I'm not even sure why, but it's kind of wrong to have a beard, for a man to have a beard for a long time. I don't know whether that still applies today, but...
Well, it's funny, because last time I went up north, Uncle Mike had a beard, and Auntie Becky came up to me and said, oh, Uncle Mike's got a beard, and she went, oh yeah, he's had one for about 6 months. She said, oh, it's a lot less strict than it used to be when you were kids. And I thought, no, it isn't. It's just that you're like, you've got so old in it that you can do what you want now. You can sort of, you know, it's like there's nothing that they could do wrong. You know what I mean? Like, once you're old and you're retired.
Yeah, what are they going to do with you?
What are they going to do with you?
No, I don't think they would shun you for wearing a beard, but there was kind of, like you say, with trousers for pants for women, it was kind of strongly disapproved of. But yeah, finding an actual article where it states it explicitly would be more difficult. But the emphasis on 1975 was definitely there for everybody. Everybody talked about it all the time. It was talked about at conventions, little dramas, which may be documented somewhere or not, that, you know, that showed that kind of thing. And I think it was only probably in the last 12 months leading up to it when there was kind of a feeling that, well, what if it doesn't happen? Maybe we'd better downplay it a little bit. Then there were kind of alternative scenarios kind of popped up, and, well, what if Jehovah doesn't bring the system to an end and blah, blah, blah. You know, how are people going to react? And he's probably testing us out and testing our loyalty and all that. And then, of course, when it didn't happen in October 1975, that was kind of testing for a lot of people. And I do believe the numbers went down right after that.
Yeah, they did, yeah. But before 1975, they had a massive influx of finances because lots of people sold up. And my friend, her mum sold a hotel in Cornwall. And donated all the money to the society. Now, why the society needed money when the new system was just about to come, I don't know. But they had a massive influx of funds then. So it was very advantageous to them. And obviously they didn't return any of that afterwards. Like, oh, hey, sorry, we were wrong. You can have your businesses and your houses back that you've sold.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, I don't remember that, but definitely, you know, they all... you know, emphasis changed after 1975. And it was still, I think, now I haven't been in touch, I haven't been a witness for a long time, and I'm not sure what people emphasise today, but I'm sure it's kind of back to an indefinite time period when this will happen. Whereas right after, even in the years after 1975, it was kind of still just around the corner. But, you know, we just kind of, like 1914, we just misinterpreted exactly what was going to happen. But it didn't change anything at this point. Over the years...
It was the this generation, wasn't it? This generation. So there was still kind of a finite end point that was got to be around about the 80s or, you know, like pushing the 1990s was really pushing it, because that generation would be like in the... In the 90s or whatever, and how many, and we were literally counting how many of them were left in the world.
Yeah, and when they all got to be 130, then the belief had to change, right?
Yes, yeah, so they changed it to an overlapping. They said it's an overlapping generation. There's a lovely little diagram of two curves that overlap. Yeah. So it's the generation that overlapped with the generation that would by no means pass away, which really leaves you open to overlapping it infinitely.
Yeah, well, it really shows that when you start interpreting Bible prophecy, Bible scripture, you can really interpret it any way you want, and you can adjust it as circumstances dictate, and that's basically what's happening, right?
Yeah, so what I was thinking was, back then, of course, now we've got phones, we can record everything. So you can go into a convention and hundreds of people can record a talk for good reasons and, you know, negative reasons. But back then, that facility really wasn't available. So now I suspect it's much harder to get away with blatant bullshit than it was back then, because people forget, and they keep, I mean, cults deliberately keep people extremely busy so that most people who really aren't academic at all or researching just forget and get lost on the treadmill and carry on and on, don't they?
And then there's always the underlying guilt trip that you're being disloyal if you do too much research and question it too much. So why don't you just accept what we say and, you know, go along with teaching as we understand it today. The light's getting brighter and all that stuff.
So one of the questions that people have now that didn't live through 1975 is like, well, why didn't everybody leave on January 1976? But if you're saying that they were kind of proposing alternative theories, like, well, what if Jehovah's testing us? That would explain why everybody didn't just go, oh, well, the jig's up.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a lot to give up, you know, as you know. Anybody who's been a witness and is kind of on the point of breaking away, it's not just accepting a fact. It's accepting a whole way of life or getting rid of a whole way of life.
That's
very difficult to do. It might be relationships, and it involves a lot of emotion and psychology, as well as just saying, ah, well, now this fact doesn't seem right, I don't accept it any longer. It's not science, is it? Like, now we've discovered a different angle on this, and we have to change the understanding of it. No, there's a lot more involved than that. So people don't give it up, because a lot of people had been with it all their lives, that put sunk everything into it, all the belief and emotion and trust, and you're not just going to give it up. You'd much rather accept some kind of, you know, modified explanation of why it didn't happen, and it's still going to happen, don't worry, don't start getting cold feet.
That's right, yeah, so you did still have that generation thing. It was definitely going to happen before those guys died. So even though it didn't happen in 75, it was still definitely going to happen. But they had a bit more slack on it, didn't they? It was going on.
I suppose for people who are still in touch, it's still definitely going to happen. But I don't know. I suppose now it might not be in our lifetime, right?
Oh, no, it's just around the corner, Dad.
Is it still just around the corner?
It's just Literally. Yeah. It's like waiting for a bus. Like, the longer you wait for the bus,
yeah,
the more you think, shall I walk to the next bus stop? And you think, nah, do you know what? If I start walking to the next bus stop, the bus will come. It's literally, yeah, it is that close.
So three Armageddons could have come along altogether then.
You'd be pretty unlucky if three came at once.
Yeah. So, thinking of the bus analogy, isn't it?
So, in 1976, were you not, like, a tiny bit pissed off? Or did you just carry on?
You know, I guess you kind of deflated, but I think there must have been some conditioning that carried you through some kind of explanation. And it's such a long time ago, it's hard to remember exactly, but no, we continued right through it and kept doing the same thing, you know, like doing what you've always done, and we just have to rethink it. And but when, if you look at it from an outsider's perspective and you examine it objectively, this has happened a lot of times, right? Going back to 1914 and 18 and 25, and I think even back to the 1800s.
Yeah.
Where there were definite expectations were set up based on infallible Bible prophecy, so it couldn't not happen. And then when it didn't happen, there was a rationale and, well, it's not God's fault, it's our fault, we've just misunderstood. But here's the real,
the real deal.
On
it.
This
it
is really what,
The lights got brighter. I mean, that's an absolute gift to bullshit, isn't it? Oh, well, we can see now the lights got brighter, so this next truth, this is better truth than that last truth. That
On the point of the light getting brighter, that's kind of interesting, because sometimes the light's on a switch and it goes on and off. I always remember in the early 70s, and I couldn't give you details, but if somebody went back to their Watchtower articles, if they have access, they could find it. Early 70s sometime, 72, 73. Before that, Jehovah's Witnesses had always referred to themselves as ministers. We're ministers when we go to the door. We're Christian ministers. And then there was a series of articles that said why it was absolutely wrong for Christians to call themselves ministers. And I can't remember the rationale for it. But after that, for a while, it was wrong and you couldn't do it. And then a year or two later, there were another series of articles saying that we'd made a mistake, you know, that it was okay to call yourself ministers. If anybody's interested in researching that, it's interesting about the light going on and off kind of thing, you know, and off and then back on again. It's not progressing in a one direction, consistently getting brighter.
It's flip-flopping,
yeah.
Like the blood thing, you can have blood, you can't have blood, you can have fractions.
Well, I don't know about that. All I knew was you could never have blood. I mean, now, has that changed?
Oh, you can have fractions now.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't know how much of a fraction. 3/5, 5/8, 7/9.
You can quantify it,
but you can have bits of blood. You can have many separate parts, but you can't have it all in one lump.
You can't tell the whole thing, right?
I wonder if the minister thing was something to do with ministerial privilege, like where we've claimed in courts of law.
I don't know.
I reckon there's something behind that. I reckon it's the same as not charging for the literature, and we thought it was because Jehovah was a loving God, and then we found out it was because they were going to be stung for a massive tax bill.
Oh, was that it?
Yeah.
Like you say, a lot has happened since I stopped becoming a witness, so I'm kind of out of touch. I don't follow it as carefully as some people, you know. Occasionally I might take a look into it if something seems interesting or something pops up.
Yeah.
Like all the child abuse thing you're doing. I mean, when I was a witness, I had no idea about that. So,
no, I didn't.
It's all come up since then, and it's very interesting. And when witnesses come to my door, very rarely now, but when they do, I usually bring that up because, and of course they don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
They're shocked.
The media covering it is absolutely massive. There's a film that's just come out in England called Apostasy, and it's been said it's the best British independent film of the year, and it's by Jehovah's Witness, and it's about being a Jehovah's Witness, and that's going to be big, and witnesses are starting to hear of it, because I've seen people online saying that the witness relatives have said, oh, have you heard of this film called Apostasy? And The Guardian has reviewed it and said it's brilliant, so I'm going to see that, but I don't keep up with it. I think there's a point at which if you're obsessively following it, you've almost never left it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So there's a point where you need to become an ex Jehovah's Witness, I think. But I have to keep up with it enough to do the podcast, because I like doing this.
Do you think it's more difficult if you were brought up as a witness to completely leave it? You see, I have almost gone back to what I was before I ever knew about witnesses.
Yeah.
You know, I had a life of, 19, 20 years before that, where I believed certain things and political ideas, and I've kind of gone back to that now. So it's being a witness was kind of an interlude in my life, whereas for somebody brought up with it, like yourself, it was changing direction, but still having been kind of weaned on Jehovah's Witness beliefs.
It's a different experience because you don't have an authentic self that you can tap into. Although there is, I mean, I've always had my personality. It's always been me. It's just that I bent it towards being a witness, and now it's sort of irrepressible. But I think it's difficult territory, really. But I think I feel angry that I wasn't. You're not allowed to have your own beliefs.
Yeah.
Like you're told, you've got to believe this or you'll die. And then I think back now, I reckon I always was an atheist. I reckon I never believed that, but I just forced myself to at the time because I had to. But I don't know. They've got the lowest retention rates of born-in people of any religion. So I can't say that people who are born-in don't leave just as much as people who converted in. I suspect they leave at the same,
same
rate. Which brings me on to how did you wake? What things helped you to wake up?
Well, I think it was breaking away physically. That you know, without going into too much detail, as you know, when I was 37, I left England and went down to South America and spent a year down there, and was more exposed. I still continue being a witness. I went to meetings down there in Lima. And associated with people, but more peripherally than I'd done when I was in England, completely steeped in it. And so I worked teaching English, and I got to know a lot of other people, and they had an influence. And I think what the actual time period that I still felt there as a witness at that time, and that it was all going to happen, Armageddon and everything. And then I spent, I had to leave Peru just to renew my visa, and I decided to spend a couple of months traveling around South America, which I did by myself. Mm-hmm. And I think just through being alone, being completely cut off and thinking about it all and realizing that wherever you go in a continent like South America, which is a pretty large continent, and there are all kinds of isolated communities, and thinking that religions are very keen, especially in places like, obviously, Russia and China and places like that are not so easily accessible to people trying to spread the good news or their own version of it. But South America is rife. But if you go to a small village in the middle of the Amazon and you're a witness and you're the first one in there with your message, you might convert the whole village and everybody wants to be part of it. But some Mormons or somebody else might get to another village and indoctrinate that village. And so, you know, just the realization that there are so many places on earth where I probably speak to a witness once every 2 years here. I had a couple of ladies stop the other day and they don't even try to talk to you. They just leave me an invitation to a convention. So people living in the middle of Mongolia, even today, if they ever meet a witness, would be very rare. And you realize that the picture that was painted for us while we were witnesses was that it was God's work. He was the Holy Spirit's directing it. It's going to reach everywhere, going to reach everybody who deserves to know it. And that's just not true. And I think it was that realization above all that made me start doubting that this could be any different to any other group who's proselytizing anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I've heard that from quite a few people that I've interviewed. So one man I interviewed was in the Australian Bethel, and they used to send him to like other places round about, little countries and islands and things. And it was his travelling that made him think exactly the same, that he said, seeing these places. And remember when we got the yearbook, we used to talk about these countries and like look at Pakistan and say, oh, there's only 32 Jehovah's Witnesses there, yeah, and however many million people. But to see it, to actually, yeah, like you say, travel and see the sheer numbers of people that are going to be destroyed by God,
yeah,
simply because there isn't enough Jehovah's Witnesses to give them the message, seems really unfair.
Yeah.
Whereas academically, it's just in your head. And then, as you said before, you can suspend disbelief. You can put it on, yeah, the shelf with all the other academic things that don't really make, right, sense, but you haven't got time to think about them. I've got somebody here to say hello.
Hello.
Come in and say hello into the microphone.
Are you podcasting?
We are podcasting now, son.
Oh, I was going
to
say
something. No, say something.
No,
it's your granddad.
No, no, no. It's going to be embarrassing, don't
you? All right, okay. Are you going to bed now then, son? Mm. You want to say goodnight to granddad?
Good night.
Good night. Sleep tight.
Aww.
Norman says good night.
Joseph, Norman says good night.
Does he?
Yeah. Yes, he says, is he still alive?
I think last time I looked. Sometimes I'm not sure.
Do you still have to wake him up so that he can have his nap?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I think, I don't know if you remember this, but I'm sure you told me a long time ago that you met people from different faiths that were going through the same kind of worries about what if I leave and what if it's the truth and what if God destroys me.
I don't remember that specifically, but I think definitely for me, being at a distance and, you know, while ever you're steeped in an environment where you know, everybody's of the same mind, whatever group it is. It could be political. In this country, in the United States now, I think we're experiencing that people are brainwashed by certain political ideologies and they can't see straight anymore. So they accept that something wonderful is going to happen in the political arena, you know, which, well, it's almost like the promises the Watchtower have made.
Very cultish, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, but that's beside the point. But I think when you distance yourself and you have time to think and look at it from a distance, then you get a better perspective, you know. And that's why people have to break away and air other viewpoints and, you know, their interpretations of what it's all about. And then you won't all come to the same conclusion, you know. I know you wanted to talk about Raymond Francis' book, but what was interesting about that crisis of conscience was that from reading it, and that's the only thing I know about him from reading his book, it seemed that even though he'd broken away from the Watchtower Society because of certain things he experienced and saw and that troubled his conscience, he still basically believed the old Nine Yards. I'm sure he still was a fundamentalist and believed in Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and all that. That's the impression I got. He didn't become an atheist by any means. He just was troubled by the people he'd experienced there. But other people become completely opposed. And like I think you referred to yourself as an atheist.
Yeah.
I don't consider myself an atheist, but I really couldn't believe in any form of organized religion as it is today. I think it's all men's interpretations of something they don't understand.
What would you consider yourself?
Well, I'd say I'm an agnostic. You know, I just have an open mind on it. I think it's impossible to know. I mean, the interpretation of who's an agnostic is somebody who admits to not knowing.
No, right.
But if you broaden that out, I would say every single person on earth is an agnostic because nobody really knows whether they're of deep faith or whether they're atheists. They really don't know. So we're all agnostic in a sense.
But the people that think they know.
I mean, atheists are just as convinced that they know the answer and that there is no creator, if you like, as people who are fundamentalists. Mm. They're all
and
convinced.
Actually, an atheist can be just as irritatingly fundamentalist and determined to try and convince you of their point of view. You see, I've had a gut full of trying to convince people of any point of view. I actually have zero interest in trying to convince them. Even teaching maths, I just think, oh, well, if you're going to swear at me and you don't want to know, I'm not going to try and force you. It's so hard. You can't make other people do anything. And it's just, I've gone round and knocked doors for decades. It's really nice to just not care anymore.
Well, not to have that requirement on your shoulders that it's something you have to do. I mean, I see witnesses walking around and they walk so slowly and I feel so sorry for them because I know they'd rather not be doing it. And I see a lot of people now with little stands with magazine outside the library or in the park. And it seems like they've found a lot easier way than going and trying to persuade people. In other words, here they are, you can see what we are. If you want to know, come to us. And I wish they'd done that when I was a witness. It would have been a lot easier.
Right? No, loads of people have said that. But also, it is, you just sat there. It is enforced, wasted time, isn't it? At least when we were walking between doors, there was some movement. We probably felt we were doing something and we had that reasoning book and we probably felt that we were trying to reason with people. There's none of that now. They don't try and reason with you. As soon as you try and speak, even if it's not from a sort of I'm an XJW point of view, like if you ask them a genuine question, they just direct you to the website. They just say, well, you know, look at jw.org, and that's all they do now. And I just think it actually must feel utterly pointless sitting there for 10, you know, whatever many hours you're supposed to get, not even engaging with people.
Well, there are, you know, there'll always be some people who are more zealous, as you might say, than others. I mean, there've always been people who were very half-hearted about it and others who were real gung-ho. And so you might still come across witnesses who really want to persuade you. Last year I was on a road trip and I met a witness in a McDonald's in South Carolina. And I had a good discussion with him. He was a very nice guy. But I always bring up certain things which, you know, would have troubled me back then and would still trouble me today if I were a witness, like the one in Deuteronomy where the young girl gets raped by a stranger and his punishment is that he has to marry her. And his argument for that, which to me there is no justifying that, you know. My point is it can't come from the mind of a loving and just God. And his point was, well, we don't live under the Mosaic law. No, I said, that's not my point. I know we don't live under that. None of that applies. Ten Commandments and all that. But the point is, you believe the Bible is all written by God. So at that time, whatever it was, 3,500 years ago, when that was written, that was supposedly come from God. That's what you had to do. If you were raped and you got pregnant, you had to marry the guy who'd raped you.
That's now, what that loving God said people had to do. That was his loving arrangement.
Right, that was his loving arrangement for you and the guy who did it. So, it's not rational that somebody should believe that. That what it came from was a patriarchal society where everybody was a guy's property, right, including his wife and his daughters and his sons, and that's all it boiled down to. It was a product of human, machoism or whatever you like to call it. It didn't come from any loving God's mind, that.
Came from some kind of spiteful, bitter man's mind, didn't it?
Exactly.
Encode it into something and shroud it with some kind of spiritual thing.
But if you're a witness today and you want people to believe this, you're going to emphasize the rosy parts of it. And that was what, you know, Al Gore would call an inconvenient truth, things like that, right? That you have to deal with that. You have to explain it. You have to try and justify it where it's not justifiable at all, you know.
And this is where cults, they have like, I mean, I don't know if it's done deliberately, but they feed you the nice stuff first and reel you in. And
yeah.
Then the inconvenient stuff comes later when you're kind of stuck in there. And then
right.
You're left trying to rationalise it and balance it out. And as you say, so they get you to invest, you know, you invest first and then you've invested
yeah.
so much and then it's difficult to unpick, isn't it?
Yeah, once you've bought into it, then you have to take the rest of it. It's like cable TV, right? You want to watch five channels and there's another 500 you don't really want, but it's all bundled together. So to get those five channels that you really want, you've got to buy all the rest.
Yeah.
And that's how religion is, and I'm sure it's true for most religions.
Yeah. Now, I think today, I don't think they will get converts in, because this is so easy to... It's like, if somebody comes to my door and tries to sell me something, the first thing I'm going to do is Google it and see if
yeah.
I can get it cheaper on eBay or whatever. So I think
right.
if you come into it afresh... Now it's so much easier to debunk because there's so much information out there.
Yeah.
Back then, it was not easy to debunk. It was like you were
right.
saying to me before we started recording that what are you researching? What are you challenging? It's just an interpretation, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, how do you debunk all these? It's like a separate realm, isn't it? That religion and belief and faith. It's you can't go to a science book and, well, you can go to a science book and question it and say this really didn't make sense. Another thing that never made sense to me was the lion will eat straw just like the bull. Well, okay. So it's possible for, they always used to argue. I've heard, actually, this guy in South Carolina gave me a different interpretation to what I'd always heard before, which was that, well, God created everything perfect. Nothing in the Garden of Eden was going to kill one another and eat another creature, right? So lions and tigers originally were made to eat vegetation. So then why did God give them the alimentary canal, the digestive system
yeah.
of a carnivore? Why
yeah.
wouldn't he just make them like a horse or a cow and give them a herbivore's digestive
yeah.
system? Did it change when, you know, everything sinned? But the guy I was arguing with last year told me that they actually did eat meat. They were there to be like scavengers. They never killed anything, but animals died. So
right.
the lions and tigers were there to make sure that, or they'd all be piling up. But I'd never heard that when I was a witness.
No.
I don't know if you've
heard
that.
I never heard that when
no.
I was a
But
witness.
That was his explanation for why lions had, you know, the digestive system of a carnivore. But like that would be something you would contest from a science book and say it's not scientifically credible, you know, something like that.
But when you contest something like that, also in the face of, like you said about, you know, there's going to be this world government that's going to be perfect and we're all going to live in peace and all that, it seems a bit nitpicky, doesn't it, to whine on about the alimentary canals of tigers.
Yeah, that was one of those things. Well, Jehovah will explain it in a new order. Of
yeah.
course, we can't explain it now, but don't worry about it, you know. You're going to give up all the good things just for not understanding something like that. So that's something you have to compartmentalise, right, and say, all right, well, we'll forget that, we'll deal with that later.
And once you've got used to compartmentalising things, it can become a habit and then you get good at it. And then
right,
you
yeah.
can almost forget how many things you've compartmentalised and put up on
yeah.
that leave it to Jehovah shelf. And then I think the leave it to Jehovah shelf gets really, really overloaded and then sometimes it just comes crashing down. But for other people, it never comes crashing down. And I think they're the people that stay ill and have got kind of perennial ill health. I think there's a lot of people with lots of unspecific illness, and I think
yeah.
it's because the leave it to Jehovah shelf is so heavy that they're just creaking under the weight of it.
Well, I think there are people who never question that. I mean, if if you, I don't want to bash any other religion, but obviously Catholicism has come in for a lot of criticism since all the child abuse with priests came out there. And if you're a devout Catholic, it might have been very difficult for you to deal with that. And a lot of people have stopped being Catholics for that reason, you know, among others. The abuse in Ireland, the abuse of children in orphanages, and so on and so on. So the more that that's exposed to people through the media, the more they learn about it, the more people who think about it realize, well, this can't be true. This can't be God's will, you know, for priests to be molesting children. It's just crazy. And so, you know, they may get out of it. But others who don't question those things so much have stayed there, and they're still devout Catholics. And it's something they've been steeped in all their lives. And same with any other religion, Mormon or Christian Scientist, whatever. You know, you've been steeped in it.
Our political parties, like you say, it kind of applies to any mass ideology, doesn't it? That you're going to have some people that think things through, and then you're going to have a big mass of people that really either physically don't have the capacity to think because of their IQ, or don't want to think because it's painful. Or haven't got time to think. And I think that's another thing about cults, that they do deliberately keep you busy so that you haven't got time to think.
Yeah. Well, it's actually being disloyal by listening to other opinions and perspectives or viewpoints, right? You've been not unfaithful to the Watchtower, but unfaithful to Jehovah if you start questioning what the Watchtower says, and that's always been true.
It's a bit like a scam artist, isn't it? That you're lending him some money and you ask him for a receipt, and he's going, "Oh, what? Don't you trust me? You know, Don't you trust me? And then they kind of lean on your goodwill and your trust and your hope and your faith, and provides out of you.
Exactly.
One of the other things that I've heard from other people, when you said that you were traveling South America and it gave you that breathing space to think about it. I've heard that other people who've gone to other countries where they didn't understand the language and therefore they were just sat in the meetings but not really taking it in, and so they had that time to think. And Steve Hassan, who has written books about leaving cults, the way he got that breathing space was he was so chronically overtired with all the work that his cult was making him do. He had a massive car accident and he was in hospital for a few weeks. And therefore away, he was off the treadmill and away from the cult people and the meetings and the work. And that gave him the time and space to think. So I think definitely that breaking away from it, getting off the treadmill and having a break, helps.
Yeah. And of course, being able to talk to other people, and my wife Diane has given me a lot of different perspectives that I probably had the wraps on, you know what I mean? She's brought things up that has forced me to think about doubts I had, whereas otherwise they could easily be suppressed, you know. When I met her in South America, we had many long discussions and, you know, well, I won't go into all the details,
but
obviously
it's painful, isn't it?
Somebody with a different perspective to talk to about it.
And somebody making you challenge your beliefs and making you examine,
why
do you believe this? And it's really painful, and it can make, like, I've been in that position with people where they've been challenging me, and I've got, like, angry, and I've cried, and I realise now, looking back, it's because the thinking process was so hard, because I didn't want to examine it. I wanted it to remain under wraps. It's a real difficult thing to do that, and again, because of the painfulness of it, I suppose a lot of people don't want to go there.
Well, I don't know how much feedback you get from people who listen to your podcast, but if they do contact you, they probably express feelings like that the anguish of breaking away, and especially when the rest of your family are still, you know, witnesses, and they're maybe even cutting you off. Then that makes it even. I never had to experience that, fortunately.
You had a few snotty letters from me, didn't you? You had a few supercilious letters from me, but
Yeah, but I mean, not like I'm going to cut you off and I'll never speak to you again or anything like that.
I don't think you ever got to do fellowship, though, did you? I didn't ask.
No,
you
I should have been.
I should have been. Me too.
You might want to recommend it.
Well, I don't know what a girl has to do to get this fellowship, because I've done all. They know about me. I've phoned Bethel. I've been to the Kingdom Hall. I've taken them the child safeguarding policy. I feel quite offended that they haven't tried to disfellowship.
Yeah, like you're not worthy of being disfellowshipped.
Yeah, even a threat. Yeah, that's what I feel. I think they don't even think I'm a threat. I'm quite upset about it.
Yeah, that's terrible.
But no, that's a good question, because you did leave before me, and if you had been disfellowshipped, I wonder what would I mean, I never could. Mind you, Simon wasn't disfellowshipped, though, was he?
Oh, was that Simon?
Simon Green. He wasn't disfellowshipped. I was going to say I never cut him off, but then he wasn't disfellowshipped.
Secret is to keep moving. Don't let them know where you are.
Yeah?
They can't disfellowship you.
Fellowship you.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Of course, you know, a couple of years ago, they did give a talk at the convention and they said, well, you can shun for fun now. That's not exactly how they said it. Somebody doesn't have to be disfellowshipped for you to shun them.
No,
You can do it for recreational purposes if you don't think they're obeying Jehovah's laws.
You can just make that decision yourself, personally.
You can shun them, yeah.
Yeah.
Because what they said was, really, if somebody's not following Jehovah's laws, then you shouldn't be associating with them or mixing with them or doing any of that stuff.
So right.
They are, I mean, I think they are trying to batten down the hatches, because they're aware that people are leaving and that people aren't joining, and they're aware, I think, that there's a big problem coming down the line with the child abuse thing. So, going to Crisis of Conscience, I think you recommended that book to me, didn't you?
Yeah, I can't even remember how I came across it, but I did, and I read it and I thought it was very interesting. And of course, Raymond Franz, having been one of the governing body, I'm sure he was classed as an apostate, right? He was probably
the ringleader
of everything bad, you know, all the evil slave class or whatever it is.
When he left, there was somebody that put him up for a week, and they disfellowshipped that family.
Right.
They tried to ring fence everybody.
Yeah.
And disfellowship anyone that had any contact with him to kind of isolate the whole problem.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a very interesting book, you know, and some of the things he reveals about what went on in Watchtower headquarters, you know, are very interesting. And that was one of my questions right from the beginning. How does this all happen? All these watchtowers and books are inspired by God. There's a governing body there, and they all get together and put their heads together, and God's Holy Spirit comes on them. And it always seemed kind of a mystery, you know, like the white smoke and the black smoke coming from the Vatican, right?
Yeah.
Kind of smoke and mirrors. But it all turns out that the guy who was writing the articles was Ed Dunlap, the manager of the factory, was not even one of the 144,000, right? So, he just showed it to the Raymond's uncle, what do you call him, Freddie Franz, and he said, "Yeah, that looks okay. Let's publish it." Things like that are very amusing, you know, and very revealing.
When you're out.
Yeah.
I think what makes the book palatable is the fact that he was still essentially a big God believer, and that comes through really strongly, that he just didn't believe, he was upset by their hypocrisy, but he still essentially believed in Jehovah. And I think for somebody just leaving the truth, that makes the whole thing palatable, because he didn't come over as an angry apostate or a bitter apostate, or he came over as very loving and Christian. Now I think lots of people then go on to the next steps, which is either they find a moderate Christian belief, or they become agnostic, or they carry on and become atheist. But he obviously, it was like the 1950s, wasn't it? The era was more like you believe in God, wasn't it?
Yeah, like you don't question the basics of it, but you question the way it's been handled I'm not sure what how we would have felt. I probably have to go back and read that book again, but how we regarded the ones still there in Watchtower headquarters, you know, if they just thought they're all charlatans, or if it just went off the rails and it'll be correct. I'm not sure how. Yeah, and that's the thing to remember, though, about people who are breaking away from being witnesses, that they're not all a uniform group. They may have, like you say, totally different perspectives. Some are atheists right off the bat, and others are evolving and still believe most of it, and that may change over time.
Some become born again Christians because they sort of believe the whole Bible thing, but they interpret it differently.
Yeah, right.
I think tinkering about with beliefs is just, it's like rearranging the furniture on the Titanic.
Yeah.
In my opinion, but I get.
But it would make a big difference to your psychology. For example, if somebody jumps out of being a witness right into being, let's say, an evangelical or born again Christian, it would be like, they'd be very confident about what they believe now. Well, I've been misled for so many years. Now I've found the truth, so I don't need any support groups or reassurance. This is the truth. That's all I need to know, right? Like people going the other way, people who've been born again Christian and become witnesses. Now I've been misled for so many years. Now I've found the truth.
Now I've found the actual truth.
It's the people who are kind of come out of it and are left out in the wilderness. Which is probably the majority of people, right? They've just got disillusioned with it. And now, where do I go from here? The kind of a big void in their lives.
Well, and also, I think the witness ideology plants that in you, that if you leave, there'll be a big void. Because they keep quoting that scripture about where do I go? If I leave you, Lord, where do I go?
Right.
You don't have to go anyway. You don't have to join another church. Just go nowhere.
But because
that's been planted in you all the time, you think, well, if I leave, I've got to find the truth. I've got to find the truth. And I just think, it's all a bit...
Yeah.
It's a bit hard work, isn't it?
I think you might have to find some kind of rational explanation for your own psychological, equilibrium. But
you need a purpose. Don't you? You need your own personal purpose for continuing to live.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to be an off-the-peg set of religious beliefs. It could be that you decide you're going to, become an ecologist or an environmentalist.
Exactly.
Just believe in...
Yeah. Need something to fill that gap.
Yeah. I didn't... Did I? I don't know. I don't know if I did. Feel a gap. It was just so nice to be able to live.
Yeah, it might just be a great relief, just to escape from something that's always been burdensome to you.
It really is
a burden. It's a psychological crutch and a burden at the same time.
And it's nice to be on the other side of it and to be able to look back and think, I don't have that burden anymore, and that guilt and that worry and that anxiety. There's a lot of negative psychology about it that traps you in.
So,
that's everything that I wanted to ask you, really. That's really, really interesting.
So you think we've successfully bored all your listeners to death? They're all sleeping? Like my little
I only have three, so... they'll phone me up, all three of them, and tell me if it was terrible or not.
Okay.
So one of the things that I do at the end of each podcast is I have a song for each guest that I have on. And do you remember that reel-to-reel tape we used to have?
Yeah.
Oh God, I'm so glad you said yes. we had an old reel-to-reel tape, and we had you had a blank reel, didn't you? And then you had one with an album on it.
Yeah.
And we had, just to refresh your memory, we had Queen Jazz.
Yeah.
We had a Leo Sayer one. We had a John Denver one. And I think we had one other. We didn't have many, and I listened to them obsessively. The song that I think of you is Annie's song, because John Denver sung it, but also that man with the flute did it.
Oh, James Galway, yeah.
Him, yeah.
And you want me to sing or play the flute?
No! I want Norman to howl it. No, what will happen after I finish recording... But it'll be seamless. but you won't realise, the three listeners won't realise that I've edited it in afterwards, because it'll be completely seamless.
Okay.
I'll put Annie's song by John Denver at the end of this podcast, and then the three people listening will think that it just...
they'll sing and John Denver.
Or Annie. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why. I suppose because we had it on the reel-to-reel tip, and then you had James Galway.
Well, that's a relief. I thought you were going to ask me to close in prayer.
Have you got one?
No.
You know, at my school's a Catholic school, we have to pray all the time, but fortunately they're little set ones that you memorise and they're really short. We've got three prayers. We've got a morning offering, a lunchtime one, and a going home one. And, like, I can never remember the beginning of them, so I have to look at a teaching assistant to tell me the beginning two words, geez. And then I'm away. Then I'm away.
Oh, I didn't know it was a Catholic school you were at.
Yeah, my Catholic school.
Yeah.
I have to do the full rubber-dub-dub there, you know, the genuflecting, all that.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, you filled that void then, right?
I'm sold out to the Pope. Yeah. So thank you very much for letting me interview you.
Oh, thank you for doing it. I'm glad we got the audio eventually.
I know, maybe we can figure it out. I was so happy. And just so that everyone knows, this is probably the first time I've spoken to you in about 5 years, isn't it?
Because
I never answer the phone when you ring.
I've stopped ringing.
Oh, I'm sorry. To be honest, when my phone rings, I just think, what the hell? Why is somebody... Could this not be done by text?
Well, I get so many, beggars calling. I just... Unless I know who it is, I just don't answer it anywhere now anymore.
Joseph answered the phone the other day. And he said to me, I wasn't at home, and when I got home, he went, Mummy, a lady phoned up and asked me if I'd been in a car accident. It must have been, you know, one of those trying to sell you.
Yeah.
So, and I said, oh, you should have said to her, well, when I was driving my Ferrari the other day.
Yeah, right.
He said, could I say that? I went, of course you could, son. So, right, well, I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad we got through eventually.
A family JW podcast, JW community podcast. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
You fill up my senses like night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime. Like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Come let me love you. Let me give my life to you. Let me drown in your laughter. Let me die in your arms. Let me lay down beside you. Let me always be with you. Come, let me love you. Come love me again. like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me up.